Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of September. All things political this hour. We'll have two guests with us. Hari Srinivasan, weekend anchor at the new PBS NewsHour that debuted a week ago this past weekend. Janet Hook, later this hour, political reporter for the Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau. There's a lot going on today. At least one gunman opened fire inside a building at the Washington Navy Yard this morning. You probably know this news. Officials are saying that at least eight people now were killed and at least four were wounded, including a law enforcement officer. Police are still looking for two other potential gunmen who are wearing military-style uniforms. We'll be talking about that story for a little bit, the top of the show. Also, news about the United States and Russia reaching a deal Saturday. Syria's arsenal of chemical weapons to be removed or destroyed by the middle of 2013, but it, of course, will be extremely challenging to do that. The United Nations inspectors released their report today about chemical weapons use in Syria. Our guest, the first half hour, just released that report on Twitter, so you can go to his website and find out more information about that. And, today, this week, is the fifth anniversary of the financial collapse 5 years ago in America. We'll be talking about that. The president had a news conference this morning to be based on that, but then the shooting happened, so he talked a bit about that as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls all hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We welcome your thoughts on all of the issues that we'll be discussing and bring us into new territory if you would like. Hari Srinivasan is weekend anchor for PBS NewsHour. The show, as I said, debuted the weekend before this weekend, and he covers, you know, all kinds of issues. He had some interesting reports recently on how Americans feel about the economy right now, which is interesting. We'll talk about that. He is senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour as well. Hari, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. As the president said, another mass shooting, this one in Washington. We are getting confirmation that eight people have died now. What happens in a newsroom when this happens? Where do you go with this story? Have we reached a point where there are so many of these shootings that it disappears from the headlines, or are you looking for a special kind of analysis?
You know, unfortunately, it has become a little too commonplace. We don't necessarily have a formula or a format in the D.C. newsroom, but, you know, frankly, it's all hands on deck when there's a breaking story like this. And it's also a couple of different layers. One is people around the newsroom are making sure that their own loved ones weren't in the area, et cetera, as well as trying to get the facts right. In fact, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing on Twitter right now is apparently from Mayor Vincent Gray's account, and that says that at least 12 killed.
Oh, really?
At the Navy Yard. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a very fast-moving and developing story, but I think, you know, the NewsHour has always known that we're not in the business of having it first, and we'd rather just have it right. So by the end of today, I'm sure you'll see some sort of a recap of what happened throughout the day, and then online you'll see updates as well.
Mm-hmm. And Hari, when you have a news story like this, because we've had so many of these, is there some angle that we haven't covered as to how we can prevent these from happening? Is there some, when you sit down and deliberate a story like this, are you looking for something fresh, and what in the world could that be?
Well, I think that, for example, the Newtown shooting, which lasted, I mean, the sort of fallout from that in the news cycle lasted for so long. I mean, there were so many different attempts by different institutions at what is a new angle to the story. I think that on days like this, we're just looking at covering the bases, the bare minimum basic facts on what happened, who did it, where did it happen, when, et cetera. And then as this conversation goes further, and we see who's responsible for it, what agencies might have fallen down on the job in the process of preventing this, I think those are the kind of natural evolutions of it. But I don't necessarily know if there's that much of a fresh angle to the story until layers of the story uncover themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move to some. There's a lot going on today, isn't there?
Yeah.
Over the weekend, as you've reported on, United States and Russia reaching a deal, Syria's arsenal of chemical weapons to be removed or destroyed by the middle of next year. How in the world are they going to accomplish that in a war zone?
Yeah, you know what? In fact, I bet some of your listeners probably heard David Kay on Morning Edition today, who was a former chemical weapons inspector under the Bush administration, calling that, I think his words are incredibly optimistic. But it's, you know, it really does take boots on the ground to verify what the stockpiles are, where they are. And, I mean, just to put this in a little bit of context, you remember Colonel Gaddafi 9 years ago decided to give up his chemical weapons, and we're still finding little pockets of stuff that he hadn't officially given up. The rebels in Libya after the sort of Arab Spring, I mean, they were pointing out different caches that we had never seen before. So it is incredibly difficult to verify what's happening, and then to actually destroy the stuff takes a lot more time than just between now and next spring. And as you mentioned, in the middle of a civil war, to try to have this is optimistic.
Mm-hmm. You just posted, I know, the UN inspectors who were in Syria looking for chemical weapons, their report. What did they say?
You know, it's interesting. This is, I mean, we've all essentially known this. Human Rights Watch had come out with a report, and several other different agencies, Doctors Without Borders, they were all thinking that this was chemical weapons, that this was sarin. And then this is interesting and important because it's the UN. It's technically supposed to be politically neutral. This is from the chemical weapons inspectors. This is scientific. So this is really an absolute confirmation that the world can hang its hat on, that says, yes, sarin was used and that they were using rockets to send it in. Again, this particular report doesn't ascribe blame. It doesn't point the finger at who launched the rockets. And in fact, there's another UN agency that's looking at 14 different potential war crimes in Syria with chemical weapons. And they want to get to the point where they can point the finger and ascribe blame. But this one, I think, is important just because this is one of those primary sources, one of those pieces of paper over time that you can say, look, we've all agreed that, in fact, there were chemical weapons used. And then the kind of next step, while it does seem very slow, the next step is who did it?
Now, you've got the Pentagon press secretary saying that the possibility of unilateral American military force is still on the table. You've got the Russians saying military force is not on the table. You've got the Syrian government giving cautious approval to this whole plan that was worked out. You've got a lot of people with a lot of different thoughts about this. Isn't that problematic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously everybody would prefer a diplomatic solution to this, but at the same time, you know, there's reality and then there's the perception of reality and how powerful the perception is that did Assad win this round? Are we capitulating to or following behind Russia's diplomatic interests? And does that weaken President Obama or America's stance in the world? I mean, there's, you know, it seems like that should matter much less than actually getting the chemical weapons secured or destroyed. But unfortunately, the perceptions of reality in this sort of 24/7 Twitter sphere news cycle matter as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about the UN Security Council, Hari? I'm having difficulty understanding what their role is in all of this right now.
Well, you're not alone. I mean, ultimately, the problem is that nothing is going to get through the Security Council unless Russia and China step up and agree to it. And if they can essentially veto whatever goes through. Now, Russia is in an interesting position here because not only are they in, you know, contractual relationships in trade agreements, I should say, with Syria to supply arms and weapons, as even Bashar Assad confirms, no problem. I mean, that, you know, essentially they have a vested interest, somewhat an economic interest in supporting their ally in Syria. So if there is a threat of a military strike against one of their allies, they have a problem with it. So while the Security Council seems to at times be incapable of making a very quick decision, this is the sort of general check and balance that the United Nations had somewhere agreed on.
You had an interesting piece recently on NewsHour concerning the president, of course, spoke this morning about this week being 5 years since the financial collapse in this country, a piece about how Americans are feeling about the economy. And it showed that Americans are feeling some concern.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there seems to be a disconnect. We had a couple of conversations about it, one with Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, based on a new Wall Street Journal and NBC poll that came out this week, that you know, there is a significant concern that people have on health care and how to pay for health care. But I think number three on the list, what we talked about for a bit, was people still concerned about being able to pay for groceries, mm-hmm. that it's sort of that check-to-check kind of mentality. And, you know, the conversation we had on Sunday with Heidi Moore from The Guardian, we were talking a little bit about the disconnect between the recovery on Wall Street versus the recovery on Main Street. When you look at corporate profits, they are, for the most part, doing incredibly well. When you look at the financial sector, just on their stock performance, they're doing really, really well. If you look at the top 1%, 4%, 5% of earners, they've recovered really quite well. Well, then how is it that Main Street hasn't, or at least, the perception of themselves as being poor, for example, in this poll had increased? Why is it that so many more people feel poor today or feel like they've slipped out of the middle class today through this sort of great pause that we've had in the economy?
And why is it that we aren't hearing very much about that? You're giving us the story, but as I was looking at the story, I was thinking, this isn't something that's widely reported.
Yeah, I don't. You know, it's harder to try and quantify sentiment. I mean, there are, you know, different sentiment analysis tools on the internet today, but it's even if the raw data might show us, as I'm sure President Obama is likely to make, the bulk of his speech today, talking about all the economic indicators that are going right, that unemployment is slowly inching down. It's not going down fast enough for probably even his own liking, and certainly his critics' liking, but it is going down. And here are all these other different indicators of, you know, the country on the right track economically, but there's still a gap between, you know, you can say all the statistics and the numbers that you want, but ultimately when people come home and say, you know what, I'm still living paycheck to paycheck, I'm worried about paying for groceries, or at least that's how they respond in a poll like this, you say there's a huge disconnect here between what's happening in America on the sort of books and what's happening in real life.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't all that long ago that there were a lot of news reports about America's failing infrastructure. We're getting reports from states that the bridges are not in very good shape. I remember the president calling for stimulus to create those kinds of jobs that will fix bridges, fix the infrastructure. It's hard to believe in this political environment that those ideas are going anywhere, or are they?
Yeah, I mean, I think the infrastructure reports, you can, you know, most of the different projects around the country have perhaps a small website or two associated with it where you can track your progress. And when you actually start getting down into brass tacks and you look at specific projects and then you abstract larger, you don't see fantastic evidence of a lot of progress made. And that infrastructure problem is an incredibly significant one, not just for roads, even for facilities such as, for example, hydropower and hydroelectric dams in different parts of the country and how aged a lot of those are. And, you know, when you think about the number of people, say, for example, living downstream from some of those dams, if there was a catastrophic error in any of those structures, I mean, that's just one example. But I think when it comes to bridges, it's really difficult for communities sometimes to think a little longer term beyond this particular election cycle, because really I think that that's what politicians have kind of geared them toward. Let's think about this 2-year chunk and this next 2-year chunk. Mm-hmm. And we rarely have perhaps even the tolerance to say, okay, you know what, we really need to go ahead and make this sacrifice now for a bridge that will last the next 50 years or the next 100 years.
We're going to welcome phone calls. The other news over the weekend concerning the economy was Lawrence Summers withdrew his name for consideration to be Federal Reserve Chair. What does that mean? How important is that position? And what names are being surfaced now? We'll ask Hari that. And welcome your phone calls. Our guest is Hari Srinivasan. He's weekend anchor at the new PBS NewsHour. He is also the senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour. And as we always do, this Monday at 1 o'clock, we're looking at the major stories, political stories in the news. There was another mass shooting this morning, and police are now saying that 12 people have died in the shootings at the Washington Navy Yard. Will there be political ramifications to yet another shooting, or have we reached a point where there's not much we can do about this to make the country safer? What do you think when you're asked how you're doing economically and how the American economy is doing? The president focused on that in his news conference this morning, and I think that's an interesting question to ask you. Do you think there's a rebound going on, or are you, as many people Hari found in his report, having a hard time worrying about health insurance and even how to pay for groceries. If you want to talk about the new chair of the Federal Reserve, who that should be. And what about, this was a major story until all that started happening today, U.S. and Russia reaching this deal on Saturday with the arsenal of chemical weapons to be removed or destroyed by the middle of 2014. This, according to those who are expert in chemical weapons, the situation really has no precedent. Do you think that can be accomplished, or do you see this as being a problematic compromise? We welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us. Lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's how you reach us for all things political. Hari Srinivasan is our guest. He is weekend anchor at PBS NewsHour. Later in the hour, Janet Hook, who is political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, will be joining us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org. Chrissy is our first caller. Hi, Chrissy.
Yes, hi. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Mine is just more a comment. I'm calling from the Madison, well, actually Barneville, Wisconsin, the Madison area, and I do believe that our economy has gotten better since the president came in, but I also find and think about how far off we could be if we just would listen to some of the ideas of infrastructure and education and science to really push this country forward. Because if we don't do these things, we're going to be left behind. And I just find that the obstructionism in Congress is really holding this country back. And here in this state, I've been here all my life to watch all the good union jobs. My dad was a union worker, and so is my husband. To watch them all go has hurt this economy. And that's my comment, and I can listen to yours off the air.
Thanks, Chrissy.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's dead on. And when it comes to infrastructure, obviously there's roads and bridges, but the education one is something that regardless of who you talk to in different sectors of the economy, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's about high tech, every single CEO that I've ever met complains about the pipeline and saying, you know, we really have to do something about the education system because the problems that we're facing today are going to balloon in a really significant manner 15 to 20 years from now when these young people enter the workforce. I mean, you know, the American Graduate Series points out repeatedly that there's a million high school students that are dropping out every year. That is just not sustainable. I mean, if we think that that's not going to catch up to us, you know, we're living in a dreamland.
A million high school students.
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah. And I mean, when you compare that with how many hundreds of thousands of PhDs that are graduating in countries like China and India, obviously they have completely different population sizes. But again, it's one of those, you know, one of those huge advantages over time. It's not like we're not graduating PhDs. I think we can compete, but I think that it's going to be harder and harder for America in lots of different ways to find talent pools. So where are those next startup companies going to come from, whether it's in the tech sector or whether it's in the small shop on Main Street if people don't have basic education?
Let's go next to Bill in the Twin Cities. Hello, Bill.
Hey, good morning or afternoon.
Afternoon, Bill.
Yes.
Go right ahead, sir.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
Oh, well, I was just going to make a comment on how you were talking about has Main Street recovered or why hasn't it recovered? And, you know, you're saying people are finding it hard to buy groceries and are living paycheck to paycheck. Well, I don't know what category of people you're talking about. I've been a middle class or lower middle class working person. My wife, too, family of six, and we have always live paycheck to paycheck. And when you don't have a big paycheck, you just don't buy as many groceries or you don't buy a car. And so I'm just wondering who's saying Main Street hasn't recovered, you know, whether it would be a Republican ploy to make the Democrats look bad because, you know, somebody is saying I can't buy as many groceries as I used to. So it's a personal choice of how you spend your paychecks and what you're used to. And now, my wife and I are in better shape now than 5.5 years ago. And I'm not making any more money. We just allocate our money better.
Harry?
I wish the entire nation would be as effective as you guys are. I mean, I think as a country, we do have a significant problem in not balancing our own checkbooks. But I think that, you know, what I was responding to is essentially, this is the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, and this is obviously a sample set of 1,000-plus people, and this is their own perceptions of whether they feel poor or not has increased. And so it's not necessarily that we've, you know, cataloged 1,000 different families and their checkbooks.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve Chair for a moment and the importance of that position and Lawrence Summers withdrawing his name for consideration.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he basically, there wasn't going to be a very easy way for him to get anywhere close to a confirmation through the Senate. I mean, he was attacked by, you know, the far left as well as the far right, and he just didn't have the numbers. And so I think it was one of those, I'm going to go ahead and withdraw before I make it embarrassing. But I think what that does open the door to is, you know, the sort of the super contender for everyone's been thinking about is Janet Yellen. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I mean, she's sort of the consensus pick from the Senate side or congressional side. She's, you know, favored by the monetary policy community. She's incredibly qualified, which I think is often overlooked because so much of this conversation has been about Larry Summers that really we've kind of overlooked where she is in this. I mean, she's run the San Francisco Fed before and she's served under, you know, different Fed chairmen. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that not that she should be picked by because of her gender. I think, again, what I want to emphasize is how experienced she is. But I mean, this is one of those glass ceilings in the monetary policy community that's just lasted a really long time. I mean, I'm thankful that we have close to 100, maybe it's 98 women in Congress now, about 20 senators. But this particular job has just been one of those things where it just doesn't crack through. So, I mean, for multiple reasons, I think she'd be a great pick. But I think the administration is still considering, you know, possibly other options as well. Don Cohen was a former vice chairman. I mean, he retired after about 40 years at the Fed. Roger Ferguson, I think he was a vice chairman as well. He's currently the chief executive of the TIA CREF. So he's considered a possibility.
And how important is this position, Hari?
Well, I mean, the Fed Reserve Chairman is a fairly important position. And essentially, they're supposed to pick which direction the economy is going. And I think that their most famous tool is to figure out what we do with interest rates and whether we heat the economy back up a little or we cool it down to prevent inflation. So it is a, you know, in some senses, it's a symbolic role. But I think it still functions as a pretty important role to the administration and really to the world as how we project and forecast which directions our economic indicators are going.
Mm-hmm. Bill, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Barbara in Madison. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. What a pleasure to speak with you. I hear you every night. And I'm a very elderly person, and I remember Franklin Roosevelt helping our family. My dad was a farmer, and he reconstructed his wagon to go out and build roads that gave our family a one-upman there. But here, President Obama, bless his heart, have really knew and knows that our infrastructure needs vast attention. When the interest rates were low and are low, he wanted to go forth and create a program that would have provided immense opportunities for so many people to earn a living. And because we have these darn obstructionists, and I am angry, we have these obstructionists creating, they don't want to do anything to make Obama look good. Heaven forbid. They have sunk the ship of repairing our infrastructure, which is needy.
Hari.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult to get anything through Congress right now. I mean, it's just on almost any issue. It's a contentious debate when it doesn't have to be. And we still have you know, if it wasn't for Syria right now, we'd be back in kind of budget shutdown showdown number three or whichever number this is. So we've got a tremendous amount to get accomplished in a very, very short amount of time to get it done.
Well, and what about a budget shutdown pretty soon? When does that loom?
Yeah, you know, it kind of depends on who you ask. But technically speaking, I mean, Congress has less than a week or so to try to get a continuing resolution passed and see if the existing cuts to the sequester should continue longer. And, of course, that's complicated by right now a push to try to attach a defunding of the Affordable Care Act onto this. So it's really the machinations on Capitol Hill are anything but easy to understand.
Yeah. And all of the attempts to get Affordable Care Act repealed, that's not likely to happen. Are people doing that with midterms in mind, thinking it'll be enormously popular with the American public, Hari?
Yes. Unfortunately, the question ought to be, what aren't members of Congress doing with midterms in mind, right? I think a lot of this posturing, whether it's a call for a vote on Syria or not call for a vote, or a call for a vote on defunding the president's health care plan or not, I mean, this is literally just to try to make sure that your opposition, whatever that is painted with this particular stripe, and you can sure enough bet that the campaign ads a year from now or less are going to be, you know, there's going to be a video clip from C-SPAN of this member of Congress voting in X direction on X issue, and it'll be used against them in a court of public opinion.
Hari, thank you so much. Congratulations on the new assignment, and carry on, sir. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hari Srinivasan, who is the weekend anchor at PBS NewsHour, our guest, the first part of All Things Political this hour. We continue. Janet Hook is joining us now, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we continue our conversation about, well, we'll look more at whether or not the government will continue to be funded. That will be something to ask Janet about, and look at many of the other issues that we've discussed with Hari and others. Here's our phone number for Janet, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Janet. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Glad to be with you.
Are you in Washington today?
I am in Washington. I'm sitting in the Capitol right now.
Yeah, so things are pretty tense in that city. We hear now the updated reports are 12 people died in that mass shooting.
Yeah, it's really unnerving. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty about the extent and the cause and motivation behind it. So we're just kind of waiting to see what comes out.
Is the city, are parts of it kind of locked down?
I'm sure the whole, I haven't been down there. I'm not covering that story today, so I don't have any firsthand knowledge, but just, you know, watching on TV, there's blocks and blocks shut down. There are some schools in the area that were locked down as well. When I came into the Capitol midday, there were more policemen, you know, more careful scrutiny of bags. So there's definitely a sense of nervousness in the air, especially since the police chief just came out and said they still thought there might be two suspects.
Two, yeah.
Ooh. On the loose still. So anyway, thoughts and prayers with those who've been affected.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that. The president gave a news conference, as you know, just a little while ago, talking about what happened 5 years ago today. I'm interested in your overall assessment as to how people in Washington, the president and others, think we've recovered since 5 years ago this week. Have we?
Well, I mean, obviously things are a lot better now than they were 5 years ago this week, and kind of the parties divide on whether it's better enough or, you know, kind of who's responsible for the improvement. I mean, obviously 5 years ago this week was a searing moment in the memories of a lot of people who were involved, and, you know, it was a scary financial brink, and it, you know, wrought havoc on the economy for a good long time. Now things are improving, but there remains such deep disagreement about what policies need to be pursued to continue or to build on what recovery we have. It's in many ways, the one thing about the financial crisis 5 years ago is that at that moment, at least there was sort of some consensus about between the leaders of the two parties that something had to be done immediately because it was a crisis. Now, as the crisis eases some, you know, there's just less less agreement on where to go from here. You know, the deficit is going down, so that the people who'd been clamoring for a smaller deficit have seen some results, but they think that there's still this long-term problem that, in many ways, people are distracted from the long-term problem by the shorter-term improvements.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've covered Congress for quite some time. Hari was getting a lot of calls from people who were saying that they thought that nothing was getting done, that the Congress was being obstructionist. When it comes to the well-being of the American worker, you would think that Congress and the White House would be able to come up with a plan that would have fairly enthusiastic support, no matter what side of the aisle is, to make people more secure in this country. But we don't seem to be able to do much of anything, do we?
Boy, I have covered Congress for a long time, and I don't think I've ever seen the parties as far apart as they are right now. And because the government is divided and there is sort of this vanishing political center, it's just really hard to... I mean, the other factor, I mean, it's not just the parties to blame. What it is the problems that Congress confronts are so deep and long-term, and there's no easy answers to the long-term deficit problems. There's no easy answer to the economic problems. So that in the absence of an easy answer, people kind of tend to retreat to their partisan corners. And what I was just saying before is kind of true, which is that when things were worse, it was easier for them to come together for a compromise, so that when the economy was really in bad shape, they easily came to an agreement that, well, let's have a payroll tax holiday so workers have more money in their paycheck. Well, then when the economy got a little bit better, they said, well, maybe we can't tap revenues from the deficit like that. So you don't do that, then what do you do? And unemployment programs are extended and then they're not. So now in Congress, the next 2 months are preoccupied not with debate about how to improve the economy or make the lives of workers better. It's just these emergency things that have to be done. They have to pass a bill by September 30th to keep the government open. They have to pass another bill after that to raise the federal debt ceiling. These are essentially bookkeeping decisions, and they can't even get to them.
It seems like we just went through all of that.
Yes. Well, one hallmark of this divided government is that it only solves problems up until a deadline, and then they set a new deadline, and the operative metaphor is kicking the can down the road, and
right,
a lot of cans down our road.
Yeah. What about immigration? Is that just put off indefinitely now?
Oh, boy, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, really. I mean, if only because of time. I mean, they've just got these more things that have to be done. There is no deadline for taking care of the immigration problem. The other thing is just political space. It was kind of a hard piece of legislation to work out the differences of opinion, even in an environment that was less tense with other pressures, like the debate on Syria and the budget issues. But just as a matter of practicality, I don't see how the House has time to deal with immigration. Because, as you know, the Senate passed its bill some time ago, and mm-hmm. we're waiting to see what the House produces. They've been much less enthusiastic about the comprehensive approach to immigration. So we didn't even know what they were going to vote on, let alone when they were going to vote on it. And I just don't see very much time before the end of the year, let alone political will.
So what is everybody working on?
I'm sorry?
What is everybody working on?
Well, I mean, since they just came back from recess last week, and
right,
they've been talking about Syria and looking at these budget issues. I mean, the House was supposed to last week vote on a short-term funding bill for the government to take it after the beginning of the fiscal year, and that didn't come up because they didn't have the votes. So, strictly speaking, they weren't debating it. But so those are the immediate issues,
mm-hmm.
budget issues. And the Syria issue had been thought to be something that would be preoccupying them for a week or two or more. And so, but then because of diplomatic developments abroad, President Obama said that, you know, that it basically became a moot point whether they would vote on this resolution authorizing the strikes in Syria.
Yeah. That was all kind of a strange turn of events, wasn't it? The whole story is.
Oh, it was quite a roller coaster. A couple weeks ago when we first heard about these chemical weapons attacks in Syria, it was just a shocking thing. Nobody knew what Obama was going to do. He threatened to launch a military strike, then decided to ask Congress, and then decided he didn't need Congress and diplomatic openings emerged. We plunged into them, and so, you know, we're in a very different place than we were 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hearing about how excited people are that this is all going to work out, or are you hearing, ooh, there are a lot of problems, potential problems with this?
Well, you kind of hear both. I mean, everybody's very relieved. Nobody wants to, you know, launch military strikes. I mean, I guess there's some real hawks who are very, 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 I mean, skepticism is in order about whether or not this diplomatic initiative is in fact going to end up with Syria disarming or kind of handing over its chemical weapons. But the fact that they've even, first of all, admitted that they have them,
mm-hmm.
they didn't admit that before, and secondly, that they've committed, and the Russians have committed to keeping on them to hand them over to international control, at least the goals are there, and there's all kinds of reasons to be skeptical and cautious and dubious about whether it's actually going to happen or happen anytime soon. But I think having that good reason to not have to vote to launch a military strike is a welcome reprieve mm-hmm. for these members of Congress.
Janet Hook is our guest this half hour. She's political reporter for the Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Let's spend a little bit of time. What did you think of the deal that was struck between America and Russia concerning the chemical weapons? Syria's response, what did you think of that? Do you have hopes that this can be accomplished by the deadline of the middle of next year? Was this a political breakthrough on the part of the administration, or was it something that was led by Russia and we didn't see that coming particularly and had no choice because Congress was not about to approve military action, so it was the best way to go, and it kind of fell in our lap. What do you make of all of that? Last week at this time on All Things Political, we were talking about whether or not we should have military action, and this week it's a whole new situation. We welcome your phone calls. As always, here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I just asked for your thoughts on that, but you can talk about anything political because that's what we do this hour. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Our guest this half hour is the political reporter for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau, Janet Hook. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For those of you who are following the mass shooting in Washington at the Navy Yard today, the latest reports are that 12 people were killed. And Pete Williams is reporting via fingerprints that the ID of the gunman is the 34-year-old civilian contractor originally from Fort Worth, Texas, who had a stolen ID. All right, let's go to Brian in Milwaukee. Hello, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering about the sequester cuts and whether there's any talk about restoring the cuts that had been made and whether the defense cuts are going to be taking effect. And I'll take my call or my answer off here.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, Brian asks kind of the $20,000 question here on the Hill. My guess is that the sequester cuts that have already been made are not going to be restored. And it's really mostly a question of they're debating what terms to extend spending authority for the coming fiscal year. And it's more a question of whether they block additional cuts from taking effect. And that really is a big question. Now, the idea behind the sequester is that domestic and defense cuts would be made in equal proportion so that neither defense nor domestic spending would bear the brunt of it. And kind of a big issue right now is figuring out how to balance that because there is a lot of pressure, even from Republicans, to prevent further cuts in defense from taking effect. And their argument now there's a new log on the fire of that argument, which is that if, in fact, we're having to gear up for a potential military strike in Syria, that the idea was that it would be a particularly bad time to cut defense now. Now that we're not, I don't know whether that kind of dials back the pressure to protect the Pentagon. So there's a very complicated political balancing act here going on in terms of the defense versus domestic budgets.
But then again, we still might conduct a military strike in Syria.
You know, we might down the road. My guess is the diplomatic option is going to take months to play out, so I wouldn't expect it anytime soon. But it does kind of refocus attention on the fact that America's military might, plays a role, even if it's just a threat of a military strike.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the Lawrence Summers decision. Why did he fall out of favor with so many people?
Well, he kind of had a bad rap among liberal Democrats in particular. I mean, first of all, there's kind of this personality thing that he has a very abrasive personality, and I think a lot of people he had rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. You don't deny somebody a position in government for personality alone, but that was a big factor. Mm. But he was involved in a lot of policies when he was in the Clinton administration that advocating deregulation of financial companies and services that people think might have contributed to the financial crisis in 2008. So there was a sense that if President Obama wanted to continue the policies of the current Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, that it made more sense to appoint Janet Yellen, whereas Summers would represent more of a shift back to policies that a lot of liberals in particular mistrusted.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit more about her? It would be historic. She would be the first female, but is she substantially different than any other candidates who've been mentioned?
Well, I mean, she does have a lot of credibility from the point of view of experience. I mean, she's at the Fed right now. She's the vice chairman, and so it's thought that she kind of brings a sense of continuity and and I think that for a lot of people, that counts for a lot. I mean, she's extremely well thought of. It's not just she's there, therefore she should be appointed. She's, you know, a very accomplished economist. But I do think that a lot of people are very nervous about the tenuous state of the economic recovery, mm-hmm. that the policies that Bernanke has pursued have been successful, and that it would not be such a good idea to change course dramatically.
Mm. Let's talk politics for a little while. Senator Tom Harkin had his big steak picnic over the weekend. A lot was made about Joe Biden's shaking everybody's hand and him being there. Is he a serious candidate?
Well, who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, it's hard to imagine that Joe Biden doesn't want to run for president. It really is very hard for most people to imagine that he would run against Hillary Clinton if she runs for president. Everybody assumes she's going to run for president. So, but the guy loves politics. You know, you can't tie him down. You know, you put him in a steak fry, an Iowa State Fair, and he's going to act like he's running for president.
And do you imagine that she will, Hillary Clinton?
I do. I mean, that's kind of what everybody assumes. I mean, part of it is, why not? You know, she built up a huge fan base, constituency, and, you know, developed a lot of campaigning experience, went on to, you know, expand her portfolio by being a very popular and successful Secretary of State. You know, with all that behind her, why not?
Mm-hmm. Why not? You wrote recently about, and we did a story about this some time ago, life goes so fast that it seems like it was yesterday, but it was a few months ago, I believe, the separation, the agriculture bill of food stamps. What's happened with that? You wrote about this, I think, recently, didn't you?
Yeah. Actually, I didn't. My colleague did, so I'm a little bit light on the details. But I do think what happened – well, first of all, what happened back then was traditionally the Farm Bill and nutrition programs, better known as food stamps, are usually reauthorized or debated by Congress as part of one package. It's sort of like growing food and eating food in one bill. And part of that history had to do with just sort of political coalition building, you know, that agricultural areas, farms, rural states supported the farm programs, and members of Congress from cities tended to support the nutrition programs. And so alone, probably both of those programs wouldn't be so popular. They combined them and would pass them together. So what happened was the Republicans in the House brought up the regular renewal. I think it usually comes up every 5 years. And their main mission was to cut spending. And so they had lots of provisions to curtail farm programs, but most of all, they had very deep cuts in the food stamp programs. And as a result, they didn't get enough Democratic votes to pass it. And there were some Republicans who voted against it because they thought that it didn't cut enough. So the whole package went down, and they had to break it up. So now, then they came back and they passed a separate farm bill, just the agriculture programs. And this week, I believe they're going to be bringing back a nutrition bill that also still, though, tries to cut back on food stamps rather than expanding them.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple more minutes with our guest. If you'd like to join our conversation for all things political, please feel free to do so. Our number is 800-486-8655. After all the conversations we've had about possible military action against Syria, what do you think about the agreement that was struck on Saturday to end Syria's chemical weapons program? And the UN inspectors have released their report today. We have to ask our guest what she thinks about that, showing that there was a use of chemical weapons in Syria. And, well, this deal is probably fraught with some difficulties because it has to be accomplished in such a short period of time. It has to be inspection of the chemical weapon sites. It has to be completed by November, and then they need to rid themselves of the weapons program and the weapons themselves by the middle of next year, which is not much time at all. So our phone number, if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655 is our number. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our guest is Janet Hook. Janet is political reporter for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. Rinaldo is our next caller in Minneapolis. Hi, Rinaldo.
Hi. Your guest earlier stated that Hillary Clinton was a successful Secretary of State. With all due respect, what is she successful for? And I'd like for her to elaborate. And also, is there any new evidence or anything going on with the Benghazi that was under her watch?
Janet?
Well, you know, you're right. I when I say she was successful, all I'm saying is that she came, I think that people feel like she represented the United States reasonably well. She had some initiatives that she pursued in terms of the international rights of women. And mostly I was talking about her in a political context. You know, I would say that her standing was enhanced because it kind of gave her an opportunity to operate on an international platform that she hadn't had before. Obviously, a lot of people think that what happened in Benghazi is a huge blot on her record. But my guess is most of the people who view it that way are Republicans who probably wouldn't support her as a candidate for president, whether or not Benghazi had happened. And I do think that the Republicans in Congress are continuing their scrutiny of the record of what happened on Benghazi. They're not going to let that slide, and that probably will be a huge issue for her that she'll have to confront if she does run for president.
Hmm. Don't you think people will have forgotten about it by then?
It could be, but I mean, I think that's part of what Republicans want to do is make sure that
people won't
forget about it.
Yeah, exactly. What a difficult job that must be, just watching both of them, the hours, the travel. Oh my gosh, it's so big, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's being Secretary of State takes you like all around the world, and it's just, and there's no time of day or night in the United States where somebody isn't up, you know, either making trouble or seeking war or peace.
Yeah, absolutely. Janet, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Janet Hook, our guest this half hour, political reporter for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau, where she says things are pretty tense. We'll get an update from NPR News as to what's going on with the mass shooting that took place at the Navy Yard. The last report that I saw was that 12 people had been killed and that they have identified the gunman, and it looks less likely that there was more than one person involved in this. We also thank Hari Srivanasan, who is the weekend anchor at PBS NewsHour and senior correspondent for that wonderful network. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this program, and thanks everybody for all of your calls. We do, just so you're reminded, because it wasn't all that long ago that we switched to a new time period for this show from mornings to afternoons, but we've had All Things Political on the air for a long, long time, and we like it, and so we just switched it from our normal 9 o'clock for many years to 1 o'clock on Monday afternoon, so we always have All Things Political. And then we do something entirely different. The second hour, I'm delighted that we'll be celebrating the poetry of Seamus Heaney, hour two of our program today. So please stay with us. If you don't know anything about his poems, you're going to like them. News is coming up here on the Ideas Network.